You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you up to date on the news that made headlines this week, and there was quite a bit of it. Our panel today, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio News, and Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television. Welcome, everyone.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Gemma.
Thanks for having us.
You know, I haven't heard Melissa and Betsy's voices in so long. It's really nice to have you guys back on the roundtable.
It's nice really nice to be back. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's Heath, it's always nice. Heath, it's always nice to have you. I've just chatted with you.
Last but not least.
I know, exactly. Okay, so let's start probably with the biggest news. And this was Governor Little holding a news conference yesterday where he unveiled a reopening plan for Idaho. And Betsy and Melissa, I know that both of you were covering that news conference. So maybe you could just kind of give us the broad view of that plan.
Sure. And I have to say, as a reporter covering the news conference, it was pretty challenging because the governor said, I've got this 4-stage plan for reopening the state, and I think that's the right thing to do. Okay, what are your questions? And my first question was, well, what's stage one?
What's the plan?
He had released it in a web document rather than outlining what was in it. And so everyone wants to know, what are the 4 stages? And so the 4 stages are: on May 1st, in stage one, most retail and churches could reopen. In stage two, if everything went right and it could proceed, and if everything doesn't go right, it would slow down. But in stage two, on May 16th, restaurants, gyms, and hair salons could reopen with social distancing measures in place. So it might not look like it did before, but those would all be in track for phase two. Stage three would start May 30th if all went well, and that would allow gatherings of 10 to 50 people with social distancing. And then if all went well, stage four would start June 13th, allowing bars, nightclubs, and movie theaters to reopen with the resumption of travel and so forth, but still with social distancing measures in place. And the governor didn't say that he was issuing a new legal order laying this out in law right away. What he said was he wanted to give the people of Idaho and the businesses of Idaho some kind of certainty as to what was coming. So this is the plan. He hasn't even yet drafted the new order that will replace the stay-at-home order that expires on April 30th. But this was letting people know where he's headed.
But there's a big caveat to all of this, and that is all of those target dates are best case scenario. And we could very easily have to slide back or even go back to a previous stage at any point if those case numbers start to go up, which is, I don't want to say likely, but it's a very real possibility.
Mm. And Melissa, you asked him, I mean, in the news conference yesterday, right? You said, is this plan a little too optimistic, maybe?
I asked specifically about the testing because, you know, we've seen in places like South Korea that have been very successful in flattening the curve, that part of that strategy was widespread testing, even with people who aren't symptomatic. The problem in Idaho is that we don't have widespread testing everywhere in the state. And so we really don't know how common this virus is and how long it's been in our state, how the rural areas are doing, because we're still hearing from viewers that testing isn't available in every single corner of the state for people who aren't, you know, critically, obviously displaying symptoms, ready to go to the emergency room, or in those frontline jobs like healthcare workers, right? And so right. Until we have a clear picture, it's really hard to say, you know, if we're going to see another spike. We've been tracking the number of tests in recent days. And earlier this week, you know, 17% of tests that they had released came back positive. You know, that so on the surface, when you look at the numbers, like, okay, we only have 36 tests that came back positive. On the surface, that looks really, really good. But when you look at the percentage, there were only on that day, like 200 tests that were released. And so a 17%, you know, positive for that batch of tests, that's fairly high still. Now that percentage has gone down in recent days, but were those tests all taken in Treasure Valley? Do we know what's going on in Lewiston, where they've had a very, very high death rate because of that outbreak in the facility, but almost no testing available in that county, except for the people who were affected by that outbreak? All of that to say, we just don't have a clear picture yet of how Idaho is really doing at flattening the curve.
So what was it, what was the governor's response, Melissa, when you did ask him about just that with the testing and this, you know, phased reopening?
The answer was pretty similar to what it's been, is Idaho continues to work on getting tests available for every single part of the state. Right now we're doing what we can. And because tests are still limited in some of those public health districts, where in places where it is limited, we are prioritizing healthcare workers. And that's been pretty consistent this, you know, for the past month and a half, I would say. Here in Treasure Valley, we have so many spots where we can drive in and get a test, and we have for a few weeks now. The efforts have really ramped up here, but the same isn't true everywhere else in the state. And I think that we here in Boise take that for granted.
Right. I think that's a really good point. Also within this news conference, Betsy, it was you and I think it was James Dawson, one of our reporters at Boise State Public Radio, that tried to nail the governor down on the actions and the comments of Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan since we have been under this stay home order. So first, can you kind of take us back to when the governor put these stay home orders in place and the response from the lieutenant governor?
So the lieutenant governor has been urging the governor not to go as far as he did in his stay-at-home orders, but she has also praised his leadership and just kind of encouraged him to take additional steps. And then on Friday, she sent him a letter saying essentially what she thought he should do next. And she said that what she thought he should do next is declare all businesses essential and let all businesses open up the day after that current stay-at-home order expires on April 30th. And she also laid out some other things she thought he should do, like some immediate tax breaks and various other things, as talking about a dark narrative that's emerging on social media about how non-essential businesses aren't important and workers aren't important. And she fears for a constitutional crisis with this administration and so on. It was fairly confrontational, that approach. And the lieutenant governor has not commented since the governor made his announcement of his four-stage plan. But at the time she sent that letter on Friday, she was scheduled to be the keynote speaker at a rally this Saturday in Rexburg to declare all jobs essential. And this was seen as one in a series of events protesting the governor's order that had been held around the state. But things have now changed. The organizers of the Rexburg rally, after what happened on Tuesday in Meridian, have changed the focus of their rally. They have disinvited Wayne Hoffman, the president of the Idaho Freedom Foundation, from being on the list of speakers. And that in rather than a rally in person in a city park because of social distancing concerns, they've turned it into an online rally or presentation that'll take place via either Facebook Live or Zoom, followed by a car parade in which people will be encouraged to have just their families in their cars and drive by local courthouses in eastern Idaho and decorate their cars with slogans and decorations and so forth in order to make the point that they want the economy to reopen, but not that they are telling people to disobey the governor's current social distancing orders. That is exactly what Wayne Hoffman and the Idaho Freedom Foundation have been telling people to do. And so right. That resulted in a big rally in front of the Capitol last Friday, and then an incident at a playground in Meridian this week, in which an activist who was staging a protest by entering a closed playground from which the closed signs and caution tape had been removed. She refused to leave. The police came and she demanded to be arrested. And she was arrested. And then Wayne and the Freedom Foundation said, "This is so terrible. They've arrested a mom for being in a park with her kids," and tried to get more rallies going and so on. And basically the Eastern Idaho group kind of went, we don't want to go there. That's not what we're about. We're not talking about civil disobedience. And Lieutenant Governor McGeehan has made a similar statement. She sent the Idaho Press a statement yesterday saying that she has not been calling for people to disobey the governor's order. and objecting to criticism from Representative Greg Cheney of the positions she's taken in critique or opposition to the governor's management of this, saying that he's lied about her. So there's certainly a split among those who have criticized the governor's actions, because I think a faction perhaps went too far.
Yeah, and we'll get back to these protests and all of that momentarily. But speaking of Representative Cheney, Heath, talk a little bit about what he was saying, because as Betsy mentioned, Betsy, didn't Lieutenant Governor McGeehan basically say to the Idaho Press that he was lying about what she's been doing?
That's right. Basically what she said, and she demanded an apology.
Yeah. Okay, so Heath, talk to us about what Representative Cheney has been doing.
Well, Representative Cheney really came out swinging and had much stronger words than even the governor, who really, the governor has had a full-blown revolt by members of his own party. I mean, let's be clear. I mean, he had a letter from co-signed by Scott Bedke and Megan Blanksma, from Republican leadership in the House, basically demanding that he scale back his stay-at-home order. Now we have McGeehan, who's walking it back at the moment. But, I mean, let's be very clear. She was going to appear at a rally with Wayne Hoffman, whose whole campaign is disobey. So certainly she was going to be with someone who is very clearly calling for people to break the order. So Cheney got on Facebook and he really ripped everybody who is pushing back on the governor's order, including McGeehan and Wayne Hoffman and actually Greg Pruitt as well from the Idaho Second Amendment Alliance. And all have been loosely aligned for a long time and certainly work together on a lot of things. And they've all been very skeptical of the governor's order. And let's not forget, even from the beginning, Janice McGeehan, she posted a kind of an odd thing on her Facebook page that made it sound like she wasn't consulted, and sort of rhetorically was like, well, not rhetorically, she asked, what do you think about it? And then had a poll on whether people supported or didn't support the stay-at-home order. I don't think it went quite as she might have hoped, because the overwhelming majority in her poll actually supported the order. So Cheney called her out. He said that McGeehan was basically wanted to be governor and was positioning herself for that. Said that Greg Pruitt was basically soliciting donations, and really, really took to task everybody involved in these kind of disobey protests.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about, go ahead, Betsy.
Well, there's another party involved in those, and that's Ammon Bundy. And I think that may be what really set Representative Cheney off. And so after the playground arrest, the Idaho Freedom Foundation put up a post naming the officer who arrested the woman and inviting people to let the Meridian police know what they thought about that. That post was taken down apparently after an hour, and Wayne Hoffman apologized for it. But as a result, Ammon Bundy and a group of his supporters went to the police officer's home that evening and shouted a lot and said some slogans and delivered a list of grievances. And there were a number of uniform officers there interacting with the crowd. And there was a lot of concern that that was perhaps not really the right tactic to go about this.
Right.
But Ammon Bundy was very clear that he thought this was exactly the right tactic to go to people's homes and target them. And I thought perhaps that was what set Representative Cheney off. Mm. Now, the big rally in front of the Capitol was co-sponsored by three groups: the Idaho Freedom Foundation, Health Freedom Idaho, which is mostly involved with parental rights and anti-vaccination concerns, and Greg Pruitt's group, the Second Amendment Alliance.
And Heath, can we go back to last Friday with that first protest at the State House? I know we talked about it a little bit in the last segment, but this was, there was basically a notice from the Idaho Freedom Foundation. I mean, it's called Disobey Idaho. And they, as Betsy mentioned, there were two other groups, but a good number of people showed up.
Yeah, there were several hundred people. There's been some numbers I think are inflated out there, but I mean, I think there were about 400 to 500 people there. So it was a pretty good crowd. And yeah, the whole rally was basically about disobeying the order. I will say some people are kind of trying to have it both ways and saying that, you know, people should voluntarily they should voluntarily take steps to protect against COVID-19, but that it shouldn't be mandatory. But I was at the rally. I saw what was happening. There was zero social distancing. Certainly Wayne Hoffman and Dustin Hurst were there with the Idaho Freedom Foundation. They were not practicing. They were mingling with the crowd, hugging people. This was basically everything that health experts are telling you not to do right at the state capitol. And it was pretty striking because certainly they were openly flouting the order. There were police there, but the police were just kind of watching. So it was, it was a major, you know, kind of thumbing their nose at the governor right at the state capitol. And it's been interesting to hear his response, which is, it was a little stronger yesterday, but it's been pretty muted.
Well, and then from there, and we should note, I mean, there have been protests at state capitals around the country for these stay home orders. But as we mentioned in our last segment, this took a whole kind of new level when this woman, Sarah Brady, basically demanded to be arrested in Meridian. And Heath, I want to thank you for listening and watching that entire tape, so no one else had to take that time because it was quite long.
It's a long video.
It's a very long video, but I mean, this then with that arrest, as Betsy mentioned, went into going to this police officer's home, going to the governor's residence and
trying to go to Dave Jepson's home, which he's moved from since.
Great.
But they tried to go to the Department of Health and Welfare director's house too.
Right. And, yes. and then from this, how then do people who are agreeing with the order, because normally when you have a protest, sometimes you have a counter protest. That's not happening.
Right.
Because everyone's staying at home.
Right. Exactly.
That's why.
And that's a really tricky thing, I think, as journalists right now. We're covering this stuff and, you know, I cover a lot of things to do with groups like AMMB. And it's very hard to fully capture sort of the opposite side of that because we don't have polling in Idaho, as far as I know, but national polls show that the vast majority of people support these stay-at-home orders. But of course, by definition, they're not going to be counter-protesting, as Melissa said, because they don't want to spread COVID-19. So they're at a bit of a disadvantage and we can get a skewed picture. And I want to be clear, you know, Ammon Bundy, like, what he did leading people to a police officer's private home, you know, that seems to have really blown up in their face. And I think that really upset a lot of people across the political spectrum. But I also want to be clear that he really hasn't turned out a lot of numbers. So, you know, I was at one of his initial meetings in Emmett, basically trying to get people to come out against this order. And there was just a few dozen people, probably about 40 people there. And that seems to be where he's been peaking with all of his rallies. So it is a small number of people. You know, the protest at the Capitol was bigger, but there are, you know, many, many people out there who do support the order who it's just hard to kind of gauge that publicly.
I think how you gauge that publicly, Heath, is the fact that people are staying home and the fact that we're seeing those numbers of new cases go down. If we truly had such a widespread opposition, and certainly there's a gray area in here, right? There are a lot of small businesses who are struggling, and there are a lot of people who are wondering if these orders went too far, who also aren't denying the science behind what the public health officials are saying, right? So the Freedom Foundation isn't the only voice out here. Ammon Bundy is not the only voice out here. They are the most vocal. They have the biggest platform, certainly. That said, if the level of unrest was really to that level, we would see more and more and more businesses reopening. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, across the state, even in communities that I've touched base with that don't have cases recorded yet, for the most part, people are complying. And I think that in itself is a show of at least understanding for what the governor is trying to do, if not outright support.
Yeah, exactly. Agreed.
Yeah, and that's such a good point, Melissa, that even in those communities that have no confirmed cases, the compliance level at the stay-home order is high.
And it's a little bit hard to gauge that because we can't travel this. This is the biggest reporting problem that I've seen. I can't go to WeIPE and see how people are holding up, right? I can't go to Montpelier. But you know, the best I can do is call people and see what's going on. And of course, there are people who are unhappy with it. Of course, there. I'm so fortunate that I still have a job. So many of my friends and neighbors and acquaintances don't, and I understand mm-hmm. that unrest absolutely. But you can have that conversation without also mocking people who are concerned about the spread of the virus. You can have that conversation without denying science and without attacking people or showing up at a police officer's home. You can have those conversations, and that's what we're trying to do on my program. We're not going to let protesters who show up at somebody's private residence, we're not going to let them dictate our coverage.
And then we get into this whole idea of, Heath, how and why have gun rights started to factor in to this whole anti-shutdown movement?
Yeah, that's an interesting part of it. It's become kind of a cry for a lot of groups, especially more far right groups and some of these so-called no compromise gun rights groups in the states, like the Idaho Second Amendment Alliance. These are elitist approach to gun rights, and they see these stay-at-home orders as a potential threat because they think a state of emergency might be used to curtail their gun rights. So what they've been doing is they've been trying to get, and with quite a bit of success at least so far, to get gun stores deemed essential businesses. There's another side of this too. With all these legislatures out of session, these gun rights groups, like the Second Amendment Alliance, to be in session, and it's a little different here because our session was going to end anyway, but they're not able to be in session and do their videos from the Capitol saying, hey, we're here at the Capitol working for your gun rights. It's a fundraising tool, and I think that this too can be used as a fundraising tool when you say, hey, your gun rights are under threat by emergency orders and we're fighting for them.
So I think there's a problem with that in Idaho, and it's a problem of fact. And that is that under the governor's order, gun stores were always exempt, were always declared essential, they were always allowed to stay open, and there is a very solid reason for that. And I found that out today while doing interviews for my Sunday column, which is on the legal and constitutional background for the stay-at-home orders. And it turns out that in all of Idaho's statutes on the governor's emergency powers, there are exemptions for gun rights. And the law says, during the continuance of any state of disaster emergency, neither the governor nor any agency of any governmental entity or political subdivision of the state shall impose restrictions, or for extreme emergencies, additional restrictions, on the lawful possession, transfer, sale, transport, storage, display, or use of firearms or ammunition. It's already in the law in Idaho. They are protected. There is no need for those groups to protest to keep the emergency orders from taking away people's guns because the law already says they can't.
So Betsy, with that though, is it then part of this idea would be that, well, but gun stores have not been deemed essential business?
But actually they have. Under the governor's original order, they were all allowed to remain open. Gun sales were not affected by the stay-at-home order. They were never shut down in this state. They were in some other states, but not here in Idaho. And I wasn't really sure why that was. I mean, there were some things that were never shut down in Idaho. Liquor stores were not, gun stores were not, but this is why on the gun stores. I mean, there may have been other reasons as well, but it would have been illegal for an emergency order to close down gun stores in Idaho. And this is because of Idaho's very, very strong gun rights laws and strong cultural atmosphere that favors gun rights. Idaho is very favorable to gun rights. And so it's kind of harder for people to complain about the tyranny of Idaho going after gun rights when basically it's not.
Real quick, I want to add something just very briefly about the protests and the extremists. I think there's a sense of why do journalists cover these guys? You know, why do you give them attention? Mm-hmm. But I think the escalation that we've seen in the past week is a really good example of why that coverage is needed. You know, because if people think it's okay to show up at somebody's house while they're, you know, presumably getting their kids down for bed or trying to eat dinner, journalists need to shine a light on that. I think, you know, Heath, you've done a fantastic job with your coverage. And I just want to put that out into the world because there has been criticism of as far as why are journalists giving these guys coverage.
And the lieutenant governor's involved as well as a lot of lawmakers. So, you know, I mean, when you have people who are in positions of power joining this, you can't really ignore it.
Absolutely.
Right. Our panel today, Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, Heath Druzan with Boise State Public Radio News, and Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television. And a little mini Melissa is joining her, a little baby Elias. I heard him a little bit, Melissa, and I wish I could see him in person. So, hey, if he makes any noise, do not worry about it.
Okay, I've been trying to mute my microphone when he's starting to yell. So,
hey, look, this is the way of the world right now. So,
it is,
right? It is.
Yes.
I mean, look, I'm waiting. I'm waiting for one of my kids. Well, my kids usually come at the very end of the show, wanting to know if they can play the Xbox. Anyway, talking about everything that's changed in the world, Betsy. One of the things that I think is really interesting that's come out of this is telehealth. And this has been something that we've seen a little bit here and there of in Idaho, but it is, I mean, it's really made a huge difference in healthcare since we've gone into this stay home order.
Absolutely. It really makes sense right now. People don't want to put themselves at risk. They don't want to put their healthcare providers at risk. So rather than go to the doctor's office, they are able to have a telehealth visit and consult with their doctor or their healthcare provider by video chat or by audio, and it's working really well. The interesting thing about this is that just 5 years ago, Idaho was one of the least receptive states in the country to telehealth, to the point that the largest telehealth provider in the world pulled out of Idaho and stopped doing business here after their doctors were having their prescribing privileges pulled, their licenses questioned, even their careers endangered for treating Idaho patients without an in-person physical exam. Now, since then, several Idaho laws have changed, culminating in really the most significant one this year. We had a law in the books this whole time saying that any telehealth visit had to be by two-way audio and video, even though nationwide, 85% of patients who do telehealth prefer just audio. And so the legislature finally agreed to change that law this year. Representative Megan Blanksma was the sponsor of that bill. It wasn't supposed to take effect until July 1st, but the governor effectively, by executive order, has put it into effect immediately because of COVID-19. And that's not the only change that he's made. By executive order, a lot of rules have been loosened, and Idaho has been made even more receptive to telehealth to the point that now we're one of the nation's leaders in this. And it is being touted as the answer for a rural state where people really don't have access to healthcare. This is a way they can get it.
And
some of these changes may extend beyond the COVID-19 outbreak, although the executive order changes are effective only for as long as the emergency is in effect.
But you do make a good point, Betsy, because we've spoken to quite a few health services organizations here on the program since the pandemic started, and so many of them have turned to telehealth, in particular mental health services, because there are people that do inpatient programs and then go home, and they may live in an area where there isn't even a therapist. So there's been such a shift in this idea of telehealth. But then speaking of mental health, I mean, Melissa, as I've said, I mean, we've spoken to North Point Recovery. We've spoken to Idaho Youth Ranch about how they are continuing these mental health services in particular. But talk about pediatric mental health. I mean, this was something that I truly, even having kids myself, had not given a lot of thought to.
Right. This story or this interview idea for Idaho Reports came out of conversations that I've had with so many other fellow parents where they've noticed that their children of all ages have been displaying signs of anxiety and mm-hmm. depression, for the younger kids regressing when it comes to sleeping or potty training or whatever. And especially with some of the younger elementary school age kids who kind of have an idea of what's happening, but can't necessarily put to words how they're feeling. I was really curious what parents and guardians can do to help those kids out and what they need to watch for. So for this week's Idaho Reports, I set up an interview with a pediatric mental health care specialist and we talked about what's normal, what families can do to help make this as easy as possible for those kids, and when we should start being concerned, because there are normal signs of stress and anxiety that are completely understandable under these circumstances. And then there are some things that really are concerning. And so I'm putting together a post with some of the resources that the Dr. Roger Olson, a pediatric mental health specialist at St. Luke's, sent to me. We're going to have that online on the Idaho Reports blog before tonight's show. I know it made me feel a little bit better as a parent, because one of the things he said is these kids are resilient, and most of them, you know, as long as we're paying attention to them, as long as we're being honest, but protecting them a little bit from what's going on, they're going to be okay. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I think it's such a good point that you make though, Melissa, because as parents, I mean, especially when all of a sudden, you know, everything that the kids know is kind of shifted in the sense of, you know, school is now at home and mom and dad are trying to figure that out. And for some parents who are lucky enough to still have their jobs, they are also then having to work on top of that. And, you know, and then you do have the regression. I mean, come on, I have an 8-year-old that's sleeping on my bedroom floor almost every single night right now. Right.
My 6-year-old's doing the same thing. Like he has not needed to crawl into bed with me for a long time. And since the earthquake, especially, it's been almost every single night.
Yeah. When that earthquake hit, I knew, like, I was like, okay. Yeah. And it has been since that. So all of us, you have like these two traumatic events. So you will put all of that up, which I think is so incredibly important right now, because there's so much that parents are juggling. I want to end by talking about the fact that we are in the midst of this pandemic, but we are also in the middle of an election year. And yet,
oh, yeah.
no one can campaign. I mean, so Melissa, one of the things that Idaho Public Television always does is you have debates, and you are supposed to be having your first debate next week.
Right. So we normally for debates, we have some minimum criteria that it takes for candidates to qualify. But this year, knowing that candidates can't campaign normally, we didn't think that was going.
I think we just lost Melissa. Melissa, can you go back a little bit? We can hear you now. So you normally have regular criteria, but because people can't campaign properly, then you dropped off for a minute.
Yeah, so we didn't think that would be a fair or accurate representation of what the campaigns are actually doing. And so this year for every single race, the congressional and the Senate races, we waived the criteria. And instead of doing an in-person debate, we're going to do remote Q&As with the candidates for each of these primary races. 6 of the 8 candidates responded that they are interested in participating. And so it's going to be, we're going to ask them questions, basic questions about how their feelings on tax policy or the role of the federal education department or public land management. Because this year, we feel it's more important than ever to make sure that we are getting information to as many voters as possible, especially our viewers in remote areas who don't mm-hmm. have the commercial TV stations necessarily to get them that information.
So I'm curious, Melissa, have there been conversations at Idaho Public Television about how you do move forward with debates once, you know, it was especially now that we have like these phases of a reopening? I mean, do you see a point potentially where that criteria might come back in place and there may be a live debate? Or is that just too far down the road to even think about?
Right now, what I'm making for dinner is too far down the road for me to think about. But I can tell you that, this conversation was specific to these primary debates. So we have three that are scheduled on May 1st, May 7th, and May 8th, all at 8:30 on Idaho Public Television. What we do for the general election is going to be largely dependent on how coronavirus has affected mm-hmm. the state, you know, just like everybody else, we're waiting to see.
Right. And because we have an election coming up on May 19th. So
absolutely,
it will be here soon. I mean, now granted, I don't know what day it is right now, but I know that that's coming up. So
right, exactly.
Okay. I mean, it's Friday because it's the reporter roundtable. That's about as far as I've got it. I want to thank all of you for coming in today. I so appreciate all of your perspective, the reporting that all of you are doing. It is so critically important right now. We've been talking with Betsy Russell with Idaho Press, Heath Drusen with Boise State Public Radio News, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, with a special appearance by that little baby Elias. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Gemma.
This is Idaho Matters.